So last week, I began a review of the Satipatthana Sutta, who's simply talking about what is mindfulness. Tonight's topic is, what is Satipatthana? The Satipatthana Sutta is probably the most useful discourse in all of the Pali Canon. And there are versions of it in all of the Buddhist world. One of my primary resources for understanding Satipatthana is a book by Naglio, Satipatthana, the Direct Path to Realization. Here's a quote from that book that briefly describes Satipatthana. Term Satipatthana can be explained as a compound of sati, mindfulness or awareness, and upatthana. Pali term upatthana literally means placing near, and in the present context refers to a particular way of being present and attending to something with mindfulness. What's the word sutta? It's a discourse or teaching. The root word for sutta or sutra in Sanskrit is the same as the word suture. It's the way a wound is tied together in order to heal. So I think that's a real interesting derivative. Now, typically it's translated as, the Satipatthana Sutta is translated as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. In fact, the first book that I ever read about Satipatthana was the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. But it really is just the establishment of mindfulness. The Four Foundations of Mindfulness book was written by a fellow named Usulananda, who's Burmese, no longer alive. Frames of reference that are talked about in this are mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of mental phenomena. Now, there are two renditions of this in the Pali Canon, the Satipatthana Sutta and the Maha Satipatthana Sutta. But Maha is translated as greater than or more inclusive, and it's much longer and has a very large and detailed commentary regarding the realizations associated with the Four Noble Truths. That's at the end of the Satipatthana Sutta, but it's just more expansive and elaborated in the Maha Satipatthana. Now, in both versions, we can assume that the reason it's at the end about the commentary about the Four Noble Truths is that the cultivation of all the different elements of the Satipatthana prior to that segment on the Four Noble Truths is preparatory to realizing the Four Noble Truths, most particularly maximizing the benefits of what's called the Noble Eightfold Path. Noble Eightfold Path, when it's fully realized, has been commented upon as being the Noble Tenfold Path. So right understanding becomes right knowledge, direct knowing, and right aspiration becomes right liberation. from dukkha. So the Buddhist world up until fairly recently assumed that the Satipatthana Sutta was actually spoken by the Buddha and memorized by his attendant Ananda and then repeated aloud to the assembly, the first assembly of the enlightened ones after the death of the Buddha, and establish what we call the Pali Canon. Pali Canon was chanted. All of the teachings of the Buddha, according to the legend, were memorized by Ananda. That was part of his agreement to become the Buddha's personal attendant, so that the Buddha would, he would accompany the Buddha through all of his visits and teachings, or the Buddha would tell him what he taught others. And apparently Ananda was one of those people who were very prized in those days, a person with a perfect memory, eidetic memory. So ostensibly, Ananda repeated all of these teachings, all the suttas, there are hundreds of them, and chanted and passed down from generation to generation until they were starting to be written down. Now, the translation that is much followed today, the Satipatthana Sutta, was actually compiled through a series of schools. There were seven different schools that described the Satipatthana, according to Bhante Sujato. Satipatthana was first written down, apparently, according to Sujato, around 20 of the common area, before the common era. So this would be several hundred years after the time of the historical Buddha. So the assumption is that they're a compilation, that the Satipatthana is a compilation of several different teachings. Because if you go to the different renderings, you see that there are some parts that are emphasized and other parts that are deleted, just not existent. Anālaya, who I've already mentioned, has written a couple of books about Satipatthana. One of them is basically analyzing these differences and trying to come to some understanding about what is valuable, what's important for us to know here in the 21st century about what was taught those thousands of years ago. Structure of the Sutta is the four foundations, or four establishments. And the way I've described it over the years that I've been doing is, imagine that you're floating over the top of a pyramid. So you're looking down at the pyramid, and there are four triangles. They all come together at the apex of the pyramid. And each one of those faces of the pyramid represents an entry into self, self in process. Now, it's important to understand that embedded within the four foundations of mindfulness, and also elaborated in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the five aggregates of clinging. So I want to kind of correlate what's found in the five aggregates of clinging with the four foundations of mindfulness. The five aggregates of clinging are form, feeling, perception, mind conditioners, and consciousness. So if we look at the aggregate of form, that's mindfulness of the body. Now, mindfulness of the body doesn't just mean the body as, you know, we experience it, habit it, if you will, but the elements of the body, pressure, temperature, movement, sound, odor, flavor, so forth and so on. So that's the form aggregate as expressed in mindfulness of the body, first foundation of mindfulness. Second foundation of mindfulness is feeling. Now, feeling is one of the aggregates. So mindfulness of feelings. Third foundation is the mind or consciousness. Consciousness is obviously one of the aggregates. Mindfulness of the mind is the third foundation of mindfulness. And the fourth foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of mental phenomena. And what I've done is I've placed perceptions and mind conditioners into that particular foundation. Now, feelings and perceptions are very closely aligned. Feelings are basically, in contemporary terms, what we call affects, AFFs. And those are impulsive, urgent feelings that are either pulled toward an experience or trying to repel against an experience or simply neutral. Perceptions are initial impressions, sort of like the instigation of attention that elaborates into the sense of self, selfing story, through the operation of the mind conditioners. So those are the four foundations as they're structured. I'm going to be talking about each of them over the next several weeks. Probably spend several weeks talking about mindfulness of mental phenomena, because there are several elements in that that are important to you and become part of one's contemplation. Way to conceptualize the structure is to imagine that these four elements, four foundations, are harmonically resonating several different frequencies: the frequency of the body, frequency of vibration of feelings, the frequency of vibration of the mind, frequency of vibration of mental phenomena. Now, when the mind is afflicted with dukkha, craving and clinging, the interaction of these different resonances are conflict, dissonance. That's what dukkha is. What we're trying to do with this practice is to bring those four elements into harmony. Now, prior to this talk tonight, there was a guided meditation, contemplation of the Satipatthana posted, along with the notes and the recording for this talk for future reference. But one of the things that I emphasized during that guided contemplation was goal. It's not to get rid of sensations in the body, feelings, what the mind creates as reflected in consciousness. It's to bring them all into harmony. What creates the dissonance, the disharmony, is craving and clinging. Way to talk about is attachment to a particular view. What's the view? The view is that there is an enduring autonomous self. That's a misperception. It's again back to the notion of perception. And another one of those misperceptions is to get hooked into the content of what's going on subjectively, not being aware of or not acknowledging the transient nature of our subjectivity, always changing. It's a flow. But when the mind is afflicted with craving and clinging, it seems like the flow stops, even though it's still going on because of craving and clinging. It seems like it stops and you kind of get hooked into this dissonant sense of an ego, a sense of self that has to be defended and or gratified depending on circumstances. So what we're trying to do with this practice is to use the characteristics of the four foundations, particularly those characteristics found in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the seven awakening factors, to investigate. It's one of the awakening factors, to mindfully investigate the experience of dissonance and to harmonize that. So there certainly be sensations in the body. There will be feelings. And the mind will be creating a sense of self. And it will be reflected in consciousness. They're not to be gotten rid of. They're to be understood as transient and fabrications. So that's what the Satipatthana is about. Now, in terms of the suttas, they're very repetitive. If you've read them, they're almost like prose poetry. A lot of terms are used over and over again. There's some rhyming in it. In terms of the English translation, I really don't know what it's like in Pali. But the reason why they're structured the way they are is because they had to be memorized. So there are certain terms that have been in a sense codified, put into refrains. Satipatthana is subject to that. Anālayo talks about the refrains that can be understood and made use of. The terminology is archaic, but it was basically repurposing the language of the day, the conceptual understanding of the day, to a different purpose. He was creating a new way of finding peace in the world, if you will. Prior to that, the Brahmin tradition was trying to appease the gods. What the Buddha was teaching was, whether there's a god or not, peace does not come from appeasing an external force. Peace comes from liberation, comes from harmonic integration of the five aggregates. So before awakening, there's the five aggregates that are afflicted by craving and clinging. After awakening, there's still the five aggregates, but they're harmonic in their functioning. After his awakening, the Buddha, you know, was very functional, perhaps more functional than before his awakening, because he did not really have an ego to gratify or defend in terms of how we understand personality. There was still a personality, and he was able to communicate in ways that were very wise, very impactful, and cultivated the elements of what I regard as the first psychology in human history. That's what drew me to Buddhism to begin with. It seems to me it's a profound psychology, and that's what motivated me to go to graduate school and become a psychotherapist, because I appreciated the psychological validity of Dharma teachings. Once you peel away the archaic terms and understand them from a different perspective, that's been the task of every generation, beginning with the time of the Buddha, is to understand the concepts intellectually, but then to put them into play through meditation and integration into one's daily life routine, so that what you were exposed to as a conceptual understanding became something that you know directly. So I've mentioned the 10 noble truths, the 10 awakening, the noble tenfold path. Right understanding is conceptual, becomes right knowledge through direct validating experience. And right intention, aspiration as a concept is realized as the sense of self is harmonized, liberated from distress and confusion. So the Buddha created this very sophisticated psychology. And the more I become sophisticated in terms of my contemporary understanding of psychology, through my studies and through my psychotherapy practice, the more I appreciate the validity of what the Buddha taught. It basically is what we would call cognitive therapy. It's an excellent system. So not only was he able to create the seeds or the roots of that, the foundations of that, if you will, but he also managed to create the social structure, the cultural structure of what was one of the first religions on the planet, which is still influencing the lives of millions of people. So that's a very important thing to understand about the Satipatthana, that it's psychologically very sophisticated, but it also provides a way to communicate between the generations that we benefit from today. Now, I mentioned Anallio, his books on the Satipatthana and his book on mindfulness breathing are primary resources in my studies. I take the Satipatthana book, actually it's a practice guide, and the Anapanasati, the mindfulness breathing book, with me on my retreats. It really helps me to read them and then sit with that. That those books are not an easy read. Trust me on that. You really want to dive into it and be willing to put time and effort into studying the books and understanding the jargon. But even saying that, what really validates it for me is my understanding of psychology, of human relations, of science. When I talk about the four foundations individually, going forward in the talks, I'm going to be bringing neuroscience into it. Those of you who've been, because I think that's part of the conceptual validation. But then I really want to understand what modern science and psychology has to say about Dharma. I want to be able to integrate that into the Dharma. So when I'm talking about the four foundations, there are going to be some parts of it that I'm going to make comments about, but not really going to dive into. One of them is contemplation of death. There's that was very appropriate in those days, but it really has no relevance to our current life experience. But there are other aspects that I'm going to expand on, elaborate on in my commentary. Now, I mentioned a few minutes ago the refrains. They're part of all of the suttas, but there are a couple of the refrains that are woven into the fabric of the Satipatthana Sutta. And I want to mention them now. I will be talking about them more thoroughly going forward. But here's a quote from the first foundation of mindfulness from the Dalio's Satipatthana book. What are the four Satipatthanas? Here, monks, in regard to the body, monk abides contemplating the body, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. In regard to feelings, he abides contemplating feelings, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. In regard to the mind, he abides contemplating the mind, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent regarding the world. In regard to dhammas, he abides diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent regarding the world. Now, there is a lot of meaning embedded in that terminology, but you have to really contemplate it, study it, to glean the benefits from it. Now, I'm going to be repeating things that I've said before, but I think they're worth repeating. First of all, let me talk about dhammas. That's the fourth foundation of mindfulness. Dhammas are mental phenomena. This whole process of awakening, it's not about sensations per se. It's not even really about feelings per se or consciousness per se. It's about what the mind creates. The dhammas are what the mind creates. The mind creates in relative to the sensations in the body, relative to feelings, relative to consciousness. That's what the process of awakening is targeting. And that'll become more clear when I dive into the various aspects of the fourth foundation. So there's a part of the refrain, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful. I talked about this last week. I'm going to be talking about it more as we go forward because it's become clear to me over the last few months, I guess, as my understanding is evolving, hopefully maturing, that these are really, really important to understand conceptually, but also to put into play. So I'll be revisiting these in their applications regarding what I just quoted, the body, feelings, the mind, and dhammas. The word diligent in Pali is atapi, and it's literally translated as diligent. Here's a quote from Anālaya. Diligent, then, amounts to keeping up one's contemplation with balanced but dedicated continuity, returning to the object meditation as soon as it is lost. There's another translation, the word ardent, since some of the other translations that I've read. Diligent is a quality of alertness ardency has a quality of engagement, of dedication. So I think that's useful. So that would be the diligence part. Clearly knowing. That's sampajanya. That has a nuanced application that I alluded to a little bit during the guided contemplation. One level of clearly knowing, very closely associated with mindfulness, is to be immediately, passionately aware of how the process of selfing is forming. So being aware that what's going on in an ongoing way is fabrication. We're making it up as we go along. Not in ways that are illusioning or demeaning. It's just simply that's the way things really are. We're making it up. Now, our default mode, the way we make it up, creates a lot of dissonance, a lot of disharmony. That's what dukkha is. But because we're making it up, the system that we call Buddhism supports the ability to harmonize that which was dissonant. We have to clearly know how to do that, how it's happening and how to do that. So that involves, in terms of sampajanya, noticing anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Anicca is the transient nature of our subjective experience. It's changing all the time, without ceasing, always changing. There's energy flowing through the brain and the body all the time, as long as we're alive. That energy is transformed into thoughts and feelings and behaviors without any hesitation, without any limitation on being alive. How we channel that energy is what this is about. So being aware of that flow is important in terms of clearly knowing. Aspect of sampajanya is a quality of detached observation, realizing that there really is no constituent autonomous self. It's a composition. It's like a symphony that's being formed from all these instruments without ceasing. We're not trying to stop the instruments from playing. We're trying to understand how the instruments create either dissonant sound or a symphony. That's what we're trying to do. That's what sampajanya is. So that points to the anatta part, the non-self part. In addition, sampajanya, the clearly knowing, also is aware of the experience of dissonance, of distress and confusion. Stress meaning some kind of emotional upheaval, desire or aversion. You know, part of that refrain, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Desires means that pleasant feeling is not attached to, identified with. It's just a feeling. It comes and it goes. You eat something, the flavor of it is pleasant. You're not supposed to get rid of the pleasant experience. You understand it as not a self and not enduring. Same is true with the confusion part. Confusion has to do with this misperceiving of the dissonance is somehow or other right. It's the way we are. It's the way we have to be. There's no choice. There's no change. And one of the things that the Buddha said, I don't remember the exact quote, but he said, you know, I created this Dharma because there is liberation. If there was no liberation, I wouldn't be teaching you this. Trust me on this, he was saying. But, you know, this trust does not mean taking it on face value. It means apply the Dharma diligently with clear comprehension. That's another translation of Sampajanya, is clear comprehension. Attention to it. And that will allow us to understand that the dissonance, the dukkha, is not necessary. It's a characteristic of identifying and letting go. Now, this identification is called Dhamma Vichaya. So Sampajanya is functionally synonymous with Dhamma Vichaya, which is one of the seven awakening factors, the investigation of mental phenomena. So, sati is the third one, which is mindfulness, very closely associated with sampajanya. In fact, it's often the two terms are combined, sati sampajanya. I've often seen translations. The translation that Analio is using has a sequence of diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful. But I've seen translations that say diligent, mindful, clearly comprehending. So they're all cooperative. And that's what we're training for. So this quality of mindfulness, sati, is immediate direct awareness without being affected by craving and clinging. That's the thing that's important to understand. When you are presently mindful, it is one of the universal wholesome mind conditioners. The next moment might be contaminated by dissonance because of craving and clinging. But when you are mindful, clearly knowing, and diligent, there is no dukkha there. In that moment of self-organization, the mind is liberated from that distress and confusion. Very important to understand. Now, this is what we call, in the Noble Eightfold Path, right mindfulness. Satipatthana is right mindfulness. Now, there's been debate among contemporary Buddhist scholars who have tremendous access to all these different schools of Buddhism that have existed for centuries, if not millennia, in their respective cultures, comparing and contrasting them, understanding their development, their history, bring that all out. One school of scholars says that the evidence supports that right mindfulness, satipatthana, the cultivation of the Eightfold Path, particularly of right mindfulness, was to create the circumstances that would support the development and realization of jhana states. Right concentration, which is next in line in the Noble Eightfold Path. In the earliest teachings, what substantiates that, the Buddha mastered various levels of jhana, all the levels that were possible. There are four form jhanas, and then within the fourth jhana, there are four more formless jhanas, very sophisticated levels of awareness. Mastering them was assumed to bring liberation from dukkha. He realized that wasn't quite happening. Dropped out of the jhanas, and from that position of having been, attention having been purified by the jhana practice, He then practiced Vipassana and realized Nirvana. Another school of scholars poses that experiencing the jhanas is not necessary in terms of realizing the benefits of right concentration. Right concentration is really the unification of the wholesome mind conditioners, particularly those aspects that are what we call the seven awakening factors, which is part of the fourth noble truth. And in fact, the realization potential of the four noble truths section comes right after section of the fourth foundation of mindfulness that elaborates on the perfection of the seven awakening factors. So I'll be diving into the seven awakening factors pretty extensively. I imagine I've done that in the past. So that's my summarization of Satipatthana on a general level, an overview, if you will. The topic for next week's discussion is going to be initiating discussion of the first foundation of mindfulness, Kaya Nupassana, mindfulness of the body. So I think that's comments that I have for tonight. The opportunity is now available for people to ask questions or make comments. And those of you who participated in the guided contemplation, if you want to ask questions or get clarification about your meditation experience during that interlude, you're certainly welcome to do that now. So, questions or comments about the general notion of what the four foundations of mindfulness is as a cognitive structure, conceptual structure. Yes, Brian.
Just my little bit of reading on the Satipatthana. I think it's the Satipatthana. That it's in 16 parts, but also I think Anelio talks about how it kind of combine. I forget exactly if it's he stretches them back out or if, you know, kind of condenses them in. How are you going to handle that in these lectures? Or,
well, the 16 parts you're talking about are the elements of the Anapanasati Sutta.
Oh, okay.
But interestingly enough, the Anapanasati Sutta is a very valuable teaching. I mentioned that I take the mindfulness of breathing, Anelio's book on mindfulness of breathing, with me on retreats. It mirrors the Satipatthana.
Yeah, that's what I've seen.
Yeah, but it doesn't have the same structure, conceptual structure. You can make connections between the two, you know, when you study it, but they're not the same. So I may bring elements of that into the discussion. I don't know yet.
Okay.
Anything else, Brian?
Well, I mean, like the Satipatthana focuses on lots of different things, the body, which can cover the breath, but also feelings and, I forget what the dhammas and I forget what the other thing was.
The mind.
While the Anapanasati Sutta, it just focuses on the breathing, correct? Or does it also focus on other things as well?
Well, it puts a great emphasis on developing mindfulness of breathing to reveal the elements of one's self-experience. Just imagine it's a different way to talk about the pyramid image,
right,
or a different way to contemplate the whole notion of harmonics, you know, the different frequencies. Each of the four foundations is a different frequency. And what we want to do is harmonize it because the frequencies are dissonant in the default mode of our experience, the dukkha characteristic. So it's developing the same kind of liberating understanding eventually, the mindfulness breathing discourse. It just does it a different way than the Satipatthana does.
Right. Okay.
Other questions or comments?
I have a question,
Peter. Yes, ma'am.
You were speaking about, as you have often made the statement about, we do this in order to take these practices out into the world, out into our daily living. And I'm wondering, this may not be the place to discuss this. It may be more appropriate in our study group, but I'm wondering if you could comment on strategies that you have used or that you have taught people to use for addressing feelings or emotions or unbeneficial states of mind that rise up in meditation. And then how do we go about bringing, how do we bring enough consciousness? First of all, you said identify and then let it go. And part of letting it go is understanding that it's impermanent. It causes suffering, and it's the development of self. There's no self there. So I do that. I'm asking this because I've had some kind of little breakthroughs recently through journaling. Doing that through journaling, and then
doing what through journaling?
Well, I found myself in the last few weeks kind of disturbing or unpleasant feelings or attitudes about life, about myself, and I have been not soothed, but maybe that's the right word, by just saying, you know, I write these things in my journal, and then like just yesterday I stopped after I had like two pages of just fairly detailed description of how I felt I was failing myself or, you know, not doing what I wanted to be doing. And then I just, once I went back and read that, I thought, okay, how can you release this? Because this is these are unbeneficial qualities of mind. And then I just sort of went through each one and said, remember, this is impermanent. Remember, this causes you suffering. And so I don't know if that, I mean.
That's good. I would add to that. Read it as if you were reading what somebody else had written. What would that prompt in your awareness?
What did you say? Read it as if what you cut out there.
If someone else had written what was in that journal.
Yeah.
What would that suggest?
Are you asking me that?
Yes.
Yeah. You're asking me to answer a hard question like that.
Might
be delusion that this person.
Delusion is one of the effects of craving and clinging. That's the confusion part of distress and confusion.
Yeah.
You could look at those journal entries and realizing, this is not a self. These are a bunch of ideas. And of course, you notice them, realizing that, you know, you had to fabricate the commentary by putting ink on paper or lead on paper if you're using a pencil, whatever. But you made those words. That's not a self.
Okay. This is so good, Peter. So let me ask you this then. I, as you know, have been for all of my career a writing teacher. And I am I write daily. And in the last few months, I haven't done it yet, but I'm really close to the point of saying, stop journaling. Stop it. It's not helping you. What do you think about that?
I mean, you can stop journaling or not. The idea is to perceive the contents of the journal from the perspective of the absence of an autonomous self.
And so why then write?
If you ever make another journal entry, read the other journals. It's the same thing. Yeah. Or keep journaling and realizing as you're writing it, this is something that's going on because the brain is sending signals to the hand and using an implement to create something on paper. Or you could do it if you're typing it into a computer, the same right. thing. Yeah. It's still the process of fabrication, and it is not it does not construe that there is a self there.
But wouldn't it be better to just quit doing that? Isn't that constructing the self?
It's not the same thing. The idea is to look at what the process of constructing, not the content. See the content as a fabrication. And there's a process that manifests it, right? Like I said, just because the Buddha experienced full awakening does not mean that his personality became dysfunctional. It was perhaps more functional because he was not trying to create an impression that would make people like him or avoid people disliking him. He was living wisdom. Well, okay, how do you get there? The journaling is a reasonable means for doing that when the right perspective is brought to that process. This is not a self. I mean, look at what you journaled 20 years ago. Right? Are you that self now?
No.
No.
Thank God.
Exactly. Well, yeah, but there might be some things that were written down that you might look and say, wow, that's pretty sharp. Right? But, yeah, you know, yeah. in either case,
right.
It's not enduring. And the other thing to understand about it is that your sense of who you are is a composite that manifests as a result of decades of acculturation.
Yes.
Important psychological concept is interpersonal attachment. We create a sense of self through interacting with other people throughout the course of one's lifetime. Those interactions create a sense of who you are. I got all kinds of stimulation because I was born apparently male, right? All the signs are there. I'm male. And I agree with that. I am cisgen male or whatever you call it. So all kinds of conditioning was put into play there. Because I'm male, I wear certain kinds of clothes. Because I'm male, certain expectations are placed on me that are not placed if I were female or if I were trans or gay or whatever. You know, so there's the sense of there being an autonomous, enduring self is not real. It's socially useful, but it's not essential. That's to me is the most important insight of Buddhism.
Yeah, I think I really, you know, as with many of us who have studied Buddhism for a long time, that's a topic we've skirted. I certainly have, but just recently in my older age, I'm coming to it, and through being assisted by you. But it really is a hard concept to wrap your brain around.
The more you cultivate those characteristics that I'll be talking about, of adapi, sati, sampajanya, the more you cultivate them, the more you cultivate samadhi, which is the unification of those factors, and paucity, which is tranquility. The mind is less and less distressed in its functioning, in its flow.
Yeah.
Easier it will be for you to actually realize, directly know, I call it the aha moment.
Right.
That your sense of self is a fabrication. So you can change it.
Yeah.
Because you're doing it already. You're just changing it, organized around right speech, right action, right livelihood.
Thank
you. That make sense?
Yes, thank you so much.
Sharon here in the room has a question or a comment. Speak up, please.
Yeah, actually, what message saying under about the actual process, is it the process of journey, or is it just that as you're talking, I'm thinking the mind keeps creating thoughts? And to me, journaling is a lot like recording those thoughts paper. The way one, if you see something and you're out in a place and you take a picture of it, to me, journal.
Yeah, it's the quality of awareness that you bring to that process. When you're saying that, Sharon, I'm remembering many, many years ago, probably before I started meditating, I went to a party, and one of the things that were part of the party was the host was turned on a tape recorder. So all this chatter going on in the room. And then we listened to it. And I heard this voice. And what occurred to me was, wow, that guy's really arrogant. And then I realized that's me. Right? So that's an insight into a sense of detachment.
Okay.
Right? Observing this phenomena and then identifying with it as a fabrication, not who I am. Because I don't experience myself as arrogant, but I do believe that there are people justifiably who would say, God, it's arrogant. Right. Know-it-alls. Right.
So what I mean is that the ability and something can be understood by different people in different ways.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, psychologically, the reason why I come across that way is that what I was a small child, but I was really bright and very verbal. And I was the kid that you went to in class when somebody had a question. So I got a lot of reinforcement being the smartest kid in the room. So that created that sense of self. Now, I've been able to modify that to become an effective Dharma teacher, right? To speak with a certain kind of conviction, but I definitely want to be sincere in understanding what I'm talking about as best I can. That's why I meditate so rigorously. Oh, other questions or comments, because we're running over time here a little bit before we wrap it up for the evening. Julian.
Yeah, just a quick question. That was regarding the guided meditation. I don't know if I didn't understand some of the comments you were giving. I remember you were mentioning about the feeling, the moment of the sensation or feeling, and then saying something like the reaction. It was associated to the reaction, but for me, that's two different things, isn't it? Or probably I just misunderstood the guidance.
The Objectively speaking, a feeling is just a feeling. There's no reaction to it. There's nothing compelling about it. It's just a feeling. When craving and clinging are operating, then there's an impulsive reactivity regarding the feeling. And feelings are the drivers of our cognition. I'll be talking about this when I talk about the second foundation of mindfulness. But you're right. You know, the more liberated the mind is, the more a feeling is just pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. There's no reactivity. Or if there is a reactivity, it's enough reactivity to get your attention. But like talking about with diligence and sampajanya, as soon as there's a knowledge of something forming, you let it go. So what could become craving and clinging starts to get some traction, but then immediately is disregarded. That helpful?
Yes. Yes, thanks.
You're welcome. All right. So next week, I'm going to begin to talk about Kaya Nupassana, the first foundation of mindfulness. It's a custom at the end of our sittings to sit in silence for a moment. Let's do that. I wish you well, folks. Hope you're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.